I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. My guest today is Grant Jerkins, back for his third North Avenue Lounge interview. Grant is a local author, and his latest book, The Ninth Step, was published on Berkeley Prime Crime last fall. The Ninth Step is the story of a high school geometry teacher who becomes obsessed with finding the hit-and-run driver who murdered his wife. Grant and I talked about the book and about his writing career, past and future. That's coming up on the next hour of the North Avenue Lounge. So the first thing I thought when I read your book, The Ninth Step, was how many AA meetings did you go to?
Well, you know, I've actually only been, I've been to about four or five maybe. And I'm not actually a card-carrying member. And I worked at a psychiatric hospital in the mid-80s when I was in college at Appalachian State in North Carolina. And I would escort or take people that were being treated for alcoholism, hardcore. I landed in a psychiatric hospital, alcoholism.
Right. I'm seeing things.
Yeah, exactly. There was one guy, I remember, who made his own moonshine, and he had, poisoned himself over time and wrecked his central nervous system. He literally walked at a 90-degree angle. I mean, bent at the waist so that his head was facing the floor. Uh-huh. So that that's hardcore when you've drank yourself to that point. So there were a few folks over the years that I escorted to AA meetings, and that's how I kind of realized that there seems to be a lot of reminiscing that goes on, mm-hmm. almost like one-upmanship of how low someone might have sank during their drinking days. And then over the years, as my drinking increased, there were times that I sat in on meetings just thinking about, I might join AA to try to get my drinking under control. But those 12 steps look like a big challenge. So I never quite made it to working on the steps.
So, do you drink now?
I stopped for about 3 years, and just this past weekend I fell off the wagon, but not like this hard
fall. Not into a bender.
Yeah, I never drank like I'm going to go get DUIs or I'm going to be violent toward my family or my personality changes in some drastic way, but it was just always, it becomes habitual, so mm-hmm. that I'm just drinking a lot kind of every night, almost compulsively, and I do feel like kind of taking a toll on my body.
Yeah.
So I probably am back in that cycle now, and I'll escalate until I get to the point where I think, I need to stop this again. And so it's, everybody in my family drinks. So it's kind of, it's familial.
Is that drinks with the italics?
Drinks. Yes.
Yeah. So you knew about AA, and did you end up going to AA meetings when you had the idea for the book to kind of get a refresher, or did you just go with...
I did not, but I did refresh myself with the AA literature, the big book, and probably, and also, and maybe more importantly, the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions books. So,
yeah.
And there's tons of stories in the AA big book, so, you're pretty covered as far as, what goes on and the kind of things that, everything in the book really, with Helen's alcoholism is really... from my own experience, not everything, not killing someone,
not running people over,
but just the compulsion and she talks a lot, or she thinks a lot about the physical toll that it's taken on her body and the idea of kind of rotting from the inside out but maintaining professionalism and maintaining her life, to anyone who might observe, she would appear to have everything under control.
She's a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, she's stressed over and over. So
the reason I start with that is because the book begins in a serious place. Like you said, you're talking about drinking. You're talking about what it does psychologically, what it does physically. There's some bad stuff that happens right at the beginning. I'm going to avoid spoilers as much as possible here. There's some bad stuff that happens, and it's very realistic. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the book starts to become much more dreamlike and almost farcical as you go. So which idea came first, the sort of black comedy of the whole book or writing about someone who was an alcoholic and dealing with that ninth step?
Writing about someone that was an alcoholic and dealing with the ninth step is really, I mean, for me, it's mainly about guilt and forgiveness, particularly being able to forgive yourself. So, I mean, I think everybody has done things that they're, you know, not proud of in their lifetime. And so I think everybody, you know, struggles with some guilt at some level because, I mean, we've all done... Have you ever seen that website? It's called, like, Post Secret?
Or, I have,
and there was a book published. Mm-hmm. And I read the book, and I think this what I'm going to mention was actually in the book, but it was, I don't remember if it was a man or a woman, but their contribution, their dark secret was that they had stolen some pencils from a classmate's desk in the second grade.
And that had stuck
And that's, you know, that's ludicrous. Yeah, this person is carrying around this burden of guilt as an adult. And they feel bad. I mean, they genuinely feel this hardcore badness in their soul for having done that. And I think, well, that's just, you know, that's silly. You need to move on. I mean, you know.
Or find something worse to obsess about.
So I think everybody carries something with them that they feel bad about. So for me, it's about are you able to forgive yourself? And, you know, and what do you need to do to forgive yourself? And sometimes it can just be about, if you hurt somebody else, getting them to forgive you or at least, you know, coming clean and letting them know what you did.
Yeah. It's been a while since the book came out. Can you still recite the ninth step?
You're right. It has been a little while since the book. Let's see. It's about the ninth step. It's about making amends. The ninth step says that wherever we can, we should make amends to those that we have harmed. Is that a
That sounds right.
It's close to it.
Unless it would do more damage.
Unless it would do more, yes.
Right. And that seems to be the little curlicue for the book, is that in a way the amends that someone tries to make do more damage.
Right.
Yeah. And did that, how long did it take you to go from writing about someone who was dealing with guilt to the series of unfortunate events? I'm going to call it that.
When I start writing, it flows pretty quickly, so I'm not, you know, struggling to come up with ideas or what might happen next. So it was pretty quick. I mean, I mean, we can all kind of imagine what kind of problems chronic drinking can get us into. So, and I like the idea that, I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, you know, the woman in the book, her name is Helen, is a veterinarian, that she's in a hit and run accident and someone ends up dead and she covers up the crime. I think that's probably on the back of the book. So, and I think and again, go back to kind of universal humanity. I think we all when we do something wrong, we want to kind of disown ourselves from
it. Right. We've done some kind of cover up. We've made sure that it would never happen. And in doing so, felt like, okay, we've handled it.
Yeah.
That by making it so no one will ever know I did it,
yes,
then I can avoid accountability.
And I think that we can turn on and turn off conscious thought so that when something really bad happens, you can just kind of turn off conscious thought and cover it up and not think about what you're doing, but go ahead and get it covered up and get yourself kind of divorced from it. But then, you know, you have the rest of your life to live and you can't keep that conscious thought turned off all the time. So then you kind of have to deal with it. So she's in the position where she has to kind of deal with it. And that's where she kind of ends up seeking help through AA and then formally, you know, realizing that she needs to make amends, you know, for what she's done to this other person.
And then that's the engine of the book, is what those amends actually turn out to be.
And it's complex for her because if, you know, the obvious answer is, well, you just turn yourself into the police. You call them up and say, I've done this horrible thing and I want to own up to it. But then if she does that, all these other people that are kind of dependent on her, it would hurt them because she would, you know, certainly be in jail for what she did. So You know, I don't know if you know how real that is, or if it's just a head game that she plays with herself. It's certainly real to a degree.
Yeah, because it does sound like a head game, though, just because you can say, oh, I probably shouldn't be punished for this because it would hurt other people to see me punished.
Right.
It'd be like, well, my parents would hate it if they found out that I had done this terrible thing, right? But
so she has employees that depend on her, animals in her clinic that depend on her, and things. So that's what she uses to kind of say, well, the way I'm going to do this, but I'm not going to do it by turning myself into the police. I'm going to go to the husband of the woman that I killed, and because I think the eighth step is confessing, so she's going to confess and then try to make amends, but that comes out wrong, and that's when the book kind of picks up speed.
And you know, it feels, I think I compared it to a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, you did. You know,
yeah, it's a very black comedy by the time we get to the end, and this to me was the fullest example of sort of James M. Cain noir.
Really?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I did get a good review that from Kirkus Reviews that I love, but they said it was a crooked or a twisted Valentine to James M. Cain and Cornell Woolrich.
Nice, yeah.
So, yeah, that was very nice. I loved that.
And you know, when we first talked for the very first North Avenue Lounge, thank you, Cain was one of your your high watermarks for crime literature. And I do feel like previously your other books were certainly inspired, but they didn't have that kind of hard-boiled Shakespearean tragedy. Mm-hmm. Someone once explained Shakespeare tragedy to me as the good end unluckily and the bad end appropriately.
I like that.
and so then, yeah, for noir, it always felt like that was the thing, that it went bad for everybody. And it's the people who are bad folks, it goes bad because of what they did. And the people who are good, it goes bad because of chance and happenstance. And
Well, chance and happenstance. And I think for me, and there's lots of little theories around noir and all that stuff, but certainly one of them is the idea of fate. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that may be the idea that interests me and sparks me the most. And so I play off the opposite of fate in this book with chaos theory. So just kind of is it chaos or was this preordained? You know.
Yeah.
So they're both kind of, they're actually both those ideas can get you out of
accountability.
Exactly. Yeah. That's, I was going to say self responsibility, which is the definition of accountability. So both those ideas kind of, you can excuse yourself if you apply either one of those ideas, because either with chaos or fate, you have no control over either, supposedly. So, so I think the fate thing is is one of the ideas that draws me a lot, and that definitely is more apparent in this book than the other two.
And the other two are A Very Simple Crime and At the End of the Road. Yeah. And A Very Simple Crime, it all comes out of one person's choices, pretty much. Someone deciding to do bad things.
Yeah.
And in the book, they almost take responsibility for those bad things. They know they're doing them. At the End of the Road has a much more fate kind of feel, right? There's that moment in the book where you reel out the life consequences of a single act. There's a child involved, and then we sort of follow her to the end of her life because of the thing that's happening at that moment in the narrative. And this one just felt like sort of a slowly cinching machine, right? That is kind of pushed these people. I keep trying to avoid any spoilers, and I sound like an idiot. These people. But, you know, it fits together neatly, and it tightens up and tightens up until at the end we have one of the classic noir problems, which is what to do with the body. So how did you feel when you finished it? Do you feel like you'd hit your Cain book, or?
I didn't feel that way. I felt good about it. It felt a lot lighter to me than the other ones.
Yeah.
It felt to me like a fun book. So I felt good about it in that regard. I think it flows the best from all of them. I don't think there's a slow spot in it necessarily. I think there's a slow spot in At the End of the Road, and the second third of A Very Simple Crime is kind of a train wreck. I think that as a whole, this one probably works the best.
Yeah. You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. My guest today is the author Grant Jerkins. We're talking about his latest book, The Ninth Step, and his writing career. How do you feel now? You've written three books and seen them published. Have you started thinking differently about literature, about stuff that you've written in the that you've read in the past? Have you started thinking differently about some of the themes that you've explored in your books? I mean, do you feel changed on the other side of three books?
I definitely feel changed. I look back at A Very Simple Crime, and you know, I'm not that crazy about that one anymore. There's things about it that I still think the first third of that book is works really well, and that I probably tapped into something that has some power to it. But the book as a whole, I don't think is completely successful. So I think I have more perspective on what I've written, and I have a more firm idea of the direction I want to go in. But I've kind of hit a wall as to where I want to go, because I turned in my fourth novel. It's called Abnormal Man. Mm-hmm. And the publisher rejected it. So that's kind of thrown me off a good bit. What my editor said, and her name is Natalie Rosenstein, I completely respect her, and she's never changed any of the words in any of my books. And I respect the fact that instead of saying, let's change this and make it different, she just said, well, we're not going to publish it. So I'll just talk for a minute. The book is about, it's about a teenage boy who's troubled. He's kind of an outcast. And he's a pyromaniac. Mm-hmm. He receives sexual gratification from playing with fire. And he kind of hooks up with an ex-convict, or a parolee, actually, who has one leg, has an artificial leg, and they work at Shoney's together. And they kind of run away together, and they run away to the Georgia Mountains. And they hook up with the man who raised the parolee. His name is Frank. They hook up that man as a pedophile, and as I said, he raised the parolee. And so the three of these people together, you know, some pretty terrible kind of things happen. So it is a disturbing book, and I'll readily say it's the darkest thing that I've written. So she said she thought it was brilliant. I'm doing air quotes, brilliant.
Right.
Which, you know, thank you. I appreciate that. But but she said there's no one to root for, and there's no one. It's too dark, and there's no one to root for.
Right.
And of course, you go back to the first book. It took me 10 years to get it published, and each rejection said the same thing: too dark, no one to root for. So yeah. The woman that published that book, I've found her limit. So now she's saying it's too dark, there's no one to root for, and it's pretty distasteful. Those were her exact words.
So there's two ways. Whoa, my microphone just jumped away from me. There's two ways. You know what? Let me not be too silly. I'm going to pause for edit. There's two ways to take that, right? Yeah. As an artist and as a, not an employee, but as a,
what's the, a contractor.
Contractor. Yeah, that's good. I like that. So, yeah. So, you know, you could, if you wanted, just write the books you wanted to write and never sell them, never even bother to try and publish them. And that would do something for you as the artist. That would be the exploration of these themes.
Yeah.
But then there's the other side that you'd like them published. You'd like to make some money off them.
Sure.
You'd like them out in the world. So which part of you responded to the rejection first?
I'll tell you, I like what you just said. I was at a writer's conference last week, and I sort of told that same story, and there was a woman in the front row, and she was laughing. She was just actively chuckling. Her body was kind of shaking as she laughed. I'm like, and it kind of offended me. I said, you know, what's so funny? And it took her a minute to gather herself, and you know, I guess she was making a comment on my artistic ideals, and she said, well, you're going to feel differently when the checks stop rolling in. So,
meaning that you were fine with not publishing the book because if they didn't want to publish it without changes, you didn't want it published. Was that the deal?
Yeah. Here's the thing. They didn't technically reject it. What they did was, they said what we would like is for Grant to withdraw this book from submission.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, they want me to withdraw it.
Pretend it never happened.
Yeah, exactly. And submit anything else. What they would, she said, we would love to see a sequel to A Very Simple Crime.
Really?
Or anything else.
Wow.
So that's great. You know, they want to keep this relationship with me open.
They weren't looking for an excuse to drop you.
Right. So I'm definitely grateful for that. And but I can't turn my back on Abnormal Man. So it's a dilemma. I mean, I love the book. I think it's by far the best thing that I've written. And I've maybe had four or five people read it, you know, other than her and the agent. And one person said it was probably one of their favorite books they'd ever read. You know, and others, you know, found it definitely, you know, compelling and readable. But it's not, you know, I guess the other books can be called thrillers maybe, but I don't think it's a thriller. It's probably just a straight up crime novel. Mm-hmm. But I'm always going to be kind of obsessed with engaging people. So I'm not going to just write something just to indulge myself. I want to make it, you know, suspenseful, for lack of a better word, where you constantly want to know what happens next. So it's not boring or a struggle to read. Here's the other thing about it, is that it's written in second person.
You mentioned this last time we talked.
So, yeah. And it's actually written, I call it a revolving second person, so that the you can literally be anybody from chapter to chapter. So it's not always the same person that is the you.
Right.
So it can be, you know, a waitress or a manager at Shoney's, or it can be one of the three main characters. And it sounds like it would be really hard to follow that, but it's actually not hard to follow. I think one of the things that I do well is I write simply, and it's typically easy, you know, easy to follow what's going on. You don't have to struggle to figure out. So I think I was successful in that regard, and that it works. So I'm excited about it. I like that second person point of view, and I like the story. I think there's a kind of a spiritual aspect to it, or an existential aspect to it. I'm jumping subjects, but, you know, with music, I listen to I love music. Music means the world to me, but I don't consume mountains of it the way some people do.
Right.
But just certain songs become important to me. So in a very real way, the Joni Mitchell song Woodstock has kind of been the impetus for two books. It's in At the End of the Road, the idea of I came upon a child of God, and he was walking along the road. You know, for me, that has nothing to do with the 60s, has nothing to do with Woodstock, has nothing to do with what she was probably singing about, but it had significant meaning for me. And in this book, it's the same Joni Mitchell Woodstock song, but the idea of we are stardust, we are golden, billion-year-old carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of all, just that idea just keeps pulled me through the book, almost in a... in a Stanley Kubrick 2001 Space Odyssey kind of way.
Right.
It's not a science fiction book, but just that whole...
that pull at the end of the movie.
Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, tied in with these criminals. And, you know, hopefully each of them is actually a good guy in their own way. But they're horrible, horrible human beings. So it's interesting. I think that you would like it.
I'd like to read it.
I mean, I would love for you to read it and see what you think. But it's definitely, I know you found At the End of the Road to be, you know, the darkest of them. So
it was brutal, man.
This is worse.
So there's no, you're not afraid that Abnormal Man is too sentimental?
No, it's not sentimental.
Okay, we got a few irons in the fire. So let's go back to the first one. So what was your reaction to that first statement of essentially, would you withdraw this book and submit something else?
Well, it was more of an emotional reaction. I was downfallen. I was depressed and dejected and hurt and, you know, all of those things, because I was on a pretty good roll.
Yeah.
I had three books published in 3 years, and they'd all been, you know, accepted without any equivocation. And
you felt like you had this down, published, like you knew what you were doing.
Yeah, exactly. I knew that this was different, but I thought they'd be with me, you know, they'd, you know, be with me on this, but they weren't. They weren't down for it at all.
Did you know when you sent it that you were pushing something? Did you feel like...
I had a sense of that, but if we were just talking about it, I would have said to you, well, there's probably a 50-50 chance they'll reject it. And intellectually,
but
I
that
knew
that. But that was just to say it? Yeah. That was just a...
Yeah, and, but I didn't, in my heart, I didn't believe that. I thought they would recognize the genius.
Do you ever find yourself trapped in that feeling that, you know, they're going to recognize the genius, that they're going to, this is, oh, I'm brilliant?
No, not too much. I mean, and I'm only kind of feeling that now because now I have a different role where I'm the defender of this book.
Right.
So it's, no one else is going to do it. So I kind of have to step up and say, you know, this is, you know, great and blah blah blah.
But, oh, how long ago did this happen? So, are you still in this process? Are you still trying?
I'm still
to
in the process.
To...
It's been a while. I'm so bad about keeping track of time, but it's probably been, you know, going on. I mean, 9 months to a year, something like that.
Really? Okay. So even before Ninth Step came out,
yes, yeah, so this came out in November, and I think that they probably rejected it 2 months prior to that. So okay. Whatever that would kind of equal out to be. So maybe 6 months,
yeah,
8 months, something like that.
Fall of 2012. Yeah.
So it was. I hated the idea that, you know, sort of every fall, every September or November, whatever, I would have a book coming out, and I just thought that that would continue. And now I know that I will not have a book published in 2013. So, I mean, it takes... The publishing machinery is so slow. So even if someone accepted this tomorrow, it would take... A short time would be 12 months, and 16 months is more realistic.
Okay. So there's this obvious break in your publishing cycle.
Yeah.
You know that's happened. How long does it take for you to write a book?
If and when I'm writing, not that long, really. Maybe 3 or 4 months it can be, because okay. I just write every day. I try to never skip a day of writing, because that well, I told someone the other day, the hardest thing about writing is starting.
Right.
So once you stop, it's next to impossible to start again.
And now you've got something to distract you with, you know, the fight for a book you've already written.
Right.
You don't have to start again. You can right. just do other stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've written a few short stories, but I haven't been working on anything of any long length thing. I'm about to start something long. So, but
and is that a decision to let Abnormal Man sit,
no.
or are you going to do these simultaneously, trying to figure out the book and write a new one?
What it is, I mean, it's hard to know what direction. I don't want to go backwards. So if I just write another thriller, if I write something that they say they want, then to me it feels like a step backwards. If I can get Abnormal Man published, then I feel like I can keep moving forward.
What's the nature of the step backwards if you write something that and by they, we're talking about Berkeley. is that right? We're talking about Berkeley Prime Crime.
It's Berkeley Prime Crime.
Okay, yeah. That's what they. When you say they want, you mean this particular publisher?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, what's the nature of the step backwards?
Well, I've never just sat down and said, "Well, I'm going to write a thriller. Or I'm going to write a noir or whatever." I've never sat down with that goal in mind. They've always just been novels to me, and I think I mentioned before that I'm compulsively aware that, you know, I want to
right you want to engage
the
yeah.
reader. So I don't want to be a literary, you know, literary writer that is not concerned about that. So that's always a primary concern of mine.
Were you thinking of someone in particular just then?
No, I wasn't. No, I mean, I could bring several particular people to mind, but I didn't. It wasn't at the moment, no.
All right. So the idea of letting commerce in is kind of that would be the step backwards.
Yeah, but I don't consciously feel that way, that it's letting in commerce. But of course, that is what it is, and I would be writing strictly to, you know, for the money or to stroke my own ego to keep publishing. So, but the project that I'm probably going to start is. I would be co-writing something with someone else, and that would kind of free me from...
That's a change-up for you,
yeah,
too, isn't
so
it?
I wouldn't be, you know, trying to write a, you know, Grant Jerkins novel. I'm writing it with a woman. Her name is Jan Thomas. She lives in California, and she's married to a police sniper. And she had written a screenplay years ago that, for various reasons, I ended up having. This producer wanted me to rewrite it, and I did this top-to-bottom rewrite. And, you know, I fell in love with the characters and the story. And the project fell apart, as 99.9% of all Hollywood projects do. It just completely
right.
fell apart. But I never turned my back on things that I love. So, you know, through the miracle of the internet, I you know, track this woman down. And I said, hey, look.
You had not talked to her before?
Oh, no. I'd never talked to her. We'd never had any contact. I don't think she even was aware that this was being rewritten. He had optioned her screenplay, but she didn't know that he was, you know, sending it out to other people to get it rewritten.
Wow.
So I contacted, and this guy, his name escapes me now, but he made the film South Central. Do you remember that film? I think it might have been in the early 90s. But, it did quite well. It was kind of a gangland drama. But... so I said, hey, look, you know, this producer, you know, say hired me. He didn't pay me any money though, but you know, he talked me into rewriting your script. And I really love what I did and I want you to read it and see what you think. And she read it and she loved what I did too, which is kind of amazing, you know, if a stranger.
That was a coin toss, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, cause I made, you know, drastic, I made enough changes that she was comfortable saying, okay, well, this is a script by Jan Thomas and Grant Jerkins, and any money we make, we're going to split 50-50. So, nice. So obviously she liked it, responded to it. And so we started a partnership with that, and I let her have the script to market as she wanted to do because, you know, I was on to my novel stuff. So, you know, she wasn't able to kind of get that off the ground. And, you know, years went by, and I just emailed her one day and said, you know, I'd love to do this as a novel. And my first pitch to her was, I'm going to write it, and you're not going to have any input. And she wisely said, it's not going to work that way. So we're co-writing it.
Yeah.
Actually, we did 30,000 words, and then I had some bad things happen in my life. My son became ill, and I just had to kind of drop everything I was doing and deal with that. He's better now, but... He's 8 years old, and he was seriously...
And that was just the end of last year, right? Yeah.
So I dealt with that. So I put the project down with 30,000 words having been completed, and I mentioned a minute ago about inertia, so I'm trying to break the inertia and pick it back up and get it finished.
This is WREK Atlanta. Today on the North Avenue Lounge, we're speaking with Grant Jerkins, the author of A Very Simple Crime, At the End of the Road, and The Ninth Step.
And so when you started that collaborative project, that was it a distraction from the Abnormal Man stuff, or?
It's going to be once I pick it back up. And like I said, I won't feel the pressure to write a certain way, you know, to produce a certain kind of novel, even though I think it'll be mainstream. It's not going to be dark at all. For me, what drew me into the project, it's about a police sniper, technically a counter sniper. I know nothing about guns, zero. I'm not a gun person at all. Jan and her husband,
right,
as you might think,
because he actually is this person.
They are steeped in gun culture. Okay, so you would not want to go knock on their door unexpected. So, you know, they've got all of that knowledge and they've lived the life. So it's about a man that, a sniper that he has, I think, 18, you know, confirmed kills. And it's not in the heat of battle where, you know, you had to save your own life or save somebody else's life. It's where he might sit for 24 or 36 hours with someone in his crosshairs and
take the shot.
That's
the thing we hear in the movies all the time.
So... And what drew me to that is not that so much as, I mean, that aspect of it I kind of am not drawn to, but I'm drawn to the idea of what has this done to this man's mind,
right,
to have taken all these lives, you know, over time, even if it's, and again, it's not kill or be killed, it's a conscious decision, and he's not even making the decision, somebody else makes that decision.
Well, this kind of suits you.
Right. So that's what drew me into it.
Well, now I'm excited to read that.
Yeah. So it's been a struggle. I wrote this long email to Jan the other day that, you know, I don't think collaboration suits me because I kind of want to have control over every little thing. And of course, that's not fair.
Right.
Collaboration. So, you know, I just kind of laid it out there of, you know, this is where I'm at, but I'm ready to pick it back up and get it finished. So, and I want this for her and her husband also, because it's been her lifelong dream to tell this story, and I want to,
right,
if I can help her get it told, then I'm happy about that. And you know, she is a writer. I mean, she can certainly pull her weight. She was a humor columnist for 15 years out in California, and she was a paramedic, an EMT, and I mean, she's got all kinds of of stories and life experiences to add to it.
Cool.
Yeah.
So while that's happening, okay, if everything is on hold during the time of the medical troubles,
yeah.
What were you doing leading up to that on Abnormal Man? Because you said you kind of had a choice, right? You could fight for it or you could start another book.
Yeah.
What's fighting for a unofficially rejected manuscript submission? Well, what does that look like?
It looks like me here today talking about it. It's exactly what it looks like. I didn't come here today because just to talk about that. But when I do get a chance to talk to someone like you, I'm going to bring it up.
Right.
I did this festival last week called the Southern Voices Festival. It's in Hoover, Alabama. It's put on by the Hoover Public Library. It's actually quite a prestigious thing to be invited to. It's Ron Rash was there. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's an amazing Southern writer, but I mean just amazing writer, period. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he's certainly known for, in fact, one of his books is being filmed as we speak. Serena and Jennifer Lawrence will be starring in it.
So, cool.
You know, you'll be hearing, you know, if you don't know Ron Rash now, you're going to, yeah, you're going to, exactly. Is she 2-time Oscar? Is that right?
We've reached the end of my knowledge.
Mine also. Anyway, so he's got.
It's only because the Oscars just happened that I know.
So he's got the Oscar winner starring in the adaptation of his film. I think she won the Oscar for.
Winter's Bone?
For Winter's Bone, which was a Daniel Woodrell book, and he's also a fine writer. So
Ozark Noir.
Yes, exactly. So he wrote, and I mean, I haven't read him extensively, but The Death of Sweet Mister is probably one of my top 10 off books of all time. I love that book. So the man can write. So you'll hear more of Ron Rash. You know, he'll become more mainstream.
I'm just going to have a list of links on the web after the show. I got to fill out all the references.
When that film hits, I've lost the tread of what.
So you're talking up Abnormal Man.
Yeah, so I'm talking up, and that's what I'm
doing.
Can
there be a campaign for people to say, and we have to avoid any calls to action here, but can there be a campaign where people would say, "Dear Berkeley, I would like to read Grant Jerkin's book, Abnormal Man?
That would be neat. I'd love that. I don't know if I'm capable of getting that off the ground, but I'm hoping that if I talk about it, maybe at some point someone who cares my agent he supports it. I don't think he completely understood it, but he likes me, he respects me, and it's been out to just two or three other publishers.
Okay, so that's okay. You're allowed to now send it around.
You know,
to other places.
I don't quite know how that works. I know we were doing it on the down low.
Oh, no.
And now I'm talking about so much time has passed at this point. I don't think anybody at Berkeley thinks, you know, I don't know what they think, but if they hear this, I mean, I've said good things about Berkeley, about my editor, and I meant
Absolutely,
them all.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they understand I want to see my book published, and they've explained to me they're not the people to do it. So
if you get a phone call, please let me know, so I can put a little note on the streaming archive of the show.
So we've sent it out just a few places because we were trying to, you know, I guess kind of test the waters a little bit. And one rejection I remember, which was from Thomas and Mercer, was very curt. It was maybe two or three sentences, and the way I interpreted it was Thomas and Mercer is not interested in publishing violent pornography. Thank you anyway.
Wow.
But then I forget who the other one was, but it's a large publisher. And he wrote a detailed response.
Really?
He felt that I captured some kind of magic in the book, and a dark magic, and a whittle my bones to bloody points magic is how you put it. And
you use that on the back of the book eventually.
So, I mean, just so complimentary, and you know, went to a lot of time and effort to write something detailed, and then kind of ended with that he had just acquired some dark option material, so his quota was kind of full on dark stuff. So I think we're getting ready to maybe send it out on a larger scale.
Right.
So we'll see what. What
would
happens.
You self-publish at this point?
I mean, never say never, but no, I mean, that's never been my dream.
That doesn't feel like the right thing.
It doesn't feel the right thing to me, and someone asked that question from the audience last week, and my response was that self-publishing is kind of like self-stimulation. You know, it feels pretty good, you know, and certainly enjoyable, and you get something from it.
But it doesn't do much.
Yeah, it's not the same as sex, you know. So I want the real thing. So I mean, that's just always that's the dream. And a lot of people have had big success with self-publishing, and I certainly think it's a valid option. There's nothing wrong with it at all. But it's just never been my dream, and that may be my age. I'm 46, so it never existed the way it does now as I was growing up. And you know, the authors that I followed and idolized didn't self-publish. But you know, Stephen Crane, I think his first book was self-published, Maggie, A Girl of the Streets. You know, he paid to have that published. Right. So it doesn't say anything bad about the quality of the writing at all. So, but at this point, no, it's not for me. But actually, if I keep striking out, I could see myself maybe doing that.
At what point do you put it away? Do you put the book away and move on completely?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I will or not.
Yeah. So, this is almost like a natural break point in your writing career.
Yeah.
It's like a moment to rethink or restart, except it's not, because all this stuff has been happening the whole time. You know, you've been writing other stuff and thinking about what you were going to do. Have you reevaluated what you want the arc of your career to be? Have you rethought anything about what you want to write? What's going on?
Well, to a degree, I've come to this realization that the single most important thing in someone's writing career is the publisher that they're with. It's actually more important than the quality of the writing. So, I don't want to call anybody out, but I mean, there's this book called,
There Comes.
It's called A Land More Kind Than Home. And it's written by a man named Wiley Cash, who I did meet at this same conference, and just gracious, nice, charming man. And his book deserves all the attention that it's gotten, and it's gotten a ton of attention. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for a while. It's here, you know, months and months and months after its publication, it's still on Southern bestseller lists. So certainly well known in the South. I mean, it was reviewed everywhere from, I guess, the New York Times, but like Entertainment Weekly. I mean, so all these mainstream outlets picked it up and it got all this great attention. And the themes and the story itself are very similar to At the End of the Road. It deals with children in the South, religion, you know, bad things happening, and it's certainly well written. But then I look at that, and I look at the End of the Road, which was published and disappeared within a month. And I think, you know, if I had been with a different publisher that pushed it, and certainly his publisher has you know, massively pushed this book, you know, I wonder, you know, could I have had some of that same kind of success? But of course, you never know, and it's a very dangerous head game to play with yourself. I mean, because the answer could be, no, your book's not as well written. You know, you just. So you even hate to even talk about that to a degree, because
right.
you just don't know.
But this is the issue of infrastructure and of marketing, and
yeah.
This is almost chance and happenstance in this way. I mean, people talk about how a book just hits at the right time, you know, and the same kind of book, the same quality book with the same themes 10 years before just didn't do it.
Yeah. I have a friend, her name is Anna Jean Mayhew. And she wrote a book called The Dry Grass of August, which has actually been quite successful. But it's about a young girl in the 1960s or 70s. And the family has a black maid, and they go on a trip into the deeper parts of the South. And it's just kind of about those experiences and the racial tensions that they encounter. But it's a far better book than The Help, yet it deals
the same. I've not read The Help. I'm only laughing because it just seems like now you're
throwing
things up in the air.
I think it's okay to badmouth successful books. I'm not going to hurt that book in any way.
Right. It's done what it's going to do.
I've noticed that Stephen King will do that. He will kick a big book in a second, but he would never talk bad about, you know, a first time novelist or a book that hasn't done that well.
That's kind of your moral duty is to pull up people and give them a shot at the chance of it, But the folks who have already gotten up to where they need to be.
So Anna Jean's book was put out, I don't remember the name of the publisher, but it was a trade paperback original, as my books have been.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a strike against you right off the bat with the mainstream reviewers and stuff. That
hardcover seems to imply
it has more prestige. It does imply authenticity. So, but she's been through several printings, and it has been successful. But then you look at the massive success of The Help, and you think, well, why not Anna Jean's book, which you would think is superior? And then you look at these massive bestsellers like The Help and the Millennium Trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I read the first book, and it was okay. And I read like a third of the second book, and I was just bored to tears with that.
I hated the second book.
It was horrible. And the first one was only okay.
I mean, I really enjoyed The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo because it was so alien. And I think this was where the translation actually helped me read it, because it was almost autistic in the way that it described what was going on. Yeah. And so I was pulled in that way. It was very cold, which fit the subject matter. Mm-hmm. And then the second two books, I just did not enjoy at all.
Yeah.
And if you really want to have a good time, you go watch those movies, the Swedish movies.
I did watch the first Swedish one. I liked it.
It's was it not hilariously bad to you?
The first one, it was okay. It didn't seem hilariously bad to me at all. You're not talking about the David Fincher, right?
No. Okay. I'm talking about the
which I did not see. I'm so over the story at this point. I love David Fincher, but I'm so sick of that story.
Exactly.
There's no way I could watch another version
of it. A big group of us who had all read it and went to see that movie, and we took along a couple of people who hadn't read it and didn't know what they were getting into. Yeah. And they felt like we had tricked them and assaulted them, you know, because of what goes on in the book and in the movie.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge. My guest today is the author Grant Jerkins. We're talking about the Millennium Trilogy and the vagaries of literary popularity.
I'm glad that you also don't like the,
yeah, I don't.
The second book, because I...
No, I couldn't finish it.
A lot of people thought it was the best one.
Well, here's the thing. Well, you say a lot of people thought it was the best. Every time... I don't talk to that many people, admittedly, but... I don't know. But any time that, you know, a big blockbuster book like that we talk about, people are all, no, I didn't like that. And they feel like they're confessing a secret. Everybody else loved it, but no, I didn't. I'm like, no... Nobody apparently liked it because everybody's saying it wasn't very good. So how does this happen?
It's our crews, right? The people that I hang with are the ones who are a little bit like me, you know, at least in some way. And probably if someone got into a fight with me about how the rest of the Millennium Trilogy was really good, I would just hang out with them less. Not because they thought that, but because if we were going to get in a fight about that, why are we friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, friends who do like the books, I'm sure we then could just say, that's fine.
Did you hop on the Gone Girl bandwagon?
Have not read it.
I'll say go ahead and read it, but that's another one where when I talk to people about it, they're like, it wasn't that good. And for me, the first, and again, massive success. So I'm not hurting Gillian Flynn by, you know, having criticism. And I loved her first two books unreservedly. But for me, the first half worked wonderfully. But the second half, which is actually very, very traditional noir, did not work for me at all. So it fell flat for me.
Now, you know, we've kind of gotten off the rails a little bit of what we were talking about. But we also are in a place that is interesting to me and sort of connects to Abnormal Man. The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises have, you know, almost universal acclaim.
Yeah.
And I disliked both movies pretty viscerally. And I feel like after those movies came out, especially The Dark Knight, I feel like there was a change in movies, in popular movies, that people were starting to... not mimic the Dark Knight in terms of, oh, now we're going to have a superhero and the Joker is a bad guy, but aesthetically, thematically, and structurally, studios did more projects that were like the Dark Knight than they had before. I think even in the promotional material for Skyfall, the new James Bond movie, someone said, we used the Dark Knight as a model for how we made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen in literature?
It does happen in literature.
you were waiting for that.
Yeah. I have a friend. His name is Peter Ferris. He's actually, are you familiar with John Ferris? I mean, he had a huge, he's retired now, but he had a huge career in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and maybe even beyond that. But he's probably best known for The Fury, and Brian De Palma did a...
Yeah, I know that movie, yeah, certainly. Okay.
Brian De Palma made a film adaptation of that book. So he's from this family. I mean, yeah. So,
was he the Dean Koontz of that time?
Literally, yeah, he was. I mean, and Stephen King, you know, talks about John Ferris as being a huge... I think the Stephen King quote is that, you know, he modeled his career after writers like John Ferris.
Nice.
So Peter, who actually lives in Kennesaw, where I live, is his son, and he just published his first book, and it's called, of course I'm blanking out on it, it's called Last Call for the Living. Yeah, I would love for you to meet Peter, because he's a huge Nick Cave fan. Peter was in a band called Cable for a while, and so you guys would definitely have music in common, if nothing else. But so his first book kind of came out. It didn't receive anywhere near the attention that it deserved. And it had a snake handling in it. There's a shootout in a snake handling church that got a lot of buzz and a lot of talk. But going back to the Wile E. Cash thing, his book had had snake handling as one of the things in it also. So it's just kind of like, you know, what do we need to do to be more
like
Wile E.?
Are you accusing Wile E. Cash of taking all of your ideas?
I'm not at all. I genuinely liked Wile E. He's a good guy. And his book does deserve the attention that it got. But so Peter, he shared with me, he wrote his second novel, and it's in manuscript form, and I read it, and it was just like, it's like he skipped novels 2, 3, 4, and 5 and just wrote a mid-career masterpiece.
Nice.
I was just completely, sometimes you can be jealous of other writers when they have a big success, but if, it's called Ghosts in the Field, if it came out and had a massive success, I would not feel one twinge of jealousy because I know it would be deserved.
You'd be like, that's the right
thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's what's supposed to happen.
Exactly. So he shared with me a rejection that he got on that novel, and it was like a rejection from a film studio. They were talking about concept and being able to distill it down into a single line or two. Mm-hmm. And typically it's studios who have to invest millions and millions and millions of dollars that want to distill things to their most basic elements. And the woman that wrote the letter talked about having just acquired a, quote, Katrina novel, mm-hmm. and how Katrina novels are hot right now and that's easy to sell. So publishers are starting to think more and more in the same way that studios do.
And following these sort of flagpole or tentpole releases with...
I hope he doesn't get mad I shared that.
You have a little time. You can touch base with him, okay. And then I can cut that if necessary. Of course, that'll ruin the whole end of the show because we're hitting on
He'll be okay. He'll be all right.
Are you just going to burn bridges on this one?
Yeah. No, he's a good guy. He'll... Even if he didn't want me to tell it, he would forgive me. So
where does this leave you? I mean, you're not even close to done with your writing life.
Yeah,
right?
I hope not. I kind of felt that way a little bit when they rejected Abnormal Man, but I'm trying to get back into it now. I don't know. I'm really trying to envision where do I go next? And I think I have to have Abnormal Man published to be able to go somewhere else, because it would be a transition novel for me.
Do you mean somewhere else publishing wise, or somewhere else career wise?
Publishing wise, and as how I'm perceived as a writer. Not that there's millions of people out there perceiving me in any kind of fashion, but if you're perceived as a thriller writer, then people want to see a thriller. I think this is kind of an in-between book that would give me the freedom to explore different things where I don't have to write the same kind of book over and over. So, mm-hmm. So I do. I think that's another reason that I want to see it published.
The book's psychologically important to you now.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So I love it. I love the book. I mean, I'm proud of the book. So. You know, newsflash, you know, writer thinks he's written a masterpiece.
Well, you know,
You know, another thing, you know, about what am I doing to publish it? I mean, to promote it and talk about it and build buzz. And I owe gratitude to you for this. Karen Slaughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Whom I met through you. I contacted her and I said, hey, look, you know, I've written this book and this is what's going on.
Can
and
you help
you read
me
it
out?
And give me a quote?
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is bad form. I don't think that you're really supposed to do that. But I'm able to take myself out of it and say, I'm an advocate for this book. This isn't about, you know, me as, you know, being a jerk or whatever. So, and she's like, yeah, yeah, I'll do it. She remembers me and she said, but if I don't love the book, I'm not going to blurb it. And you got to respect that, you know?
Yeah, that she would do an honest favor
I mean,
for you.
She is, I mean, as you know, she is huge. I mean globally, she is a huge, huge writer. And my response to her, you know, with the I won't blurb it unless I love it line was, you know, I wouldn't ask you if I didn't love your writing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want, you know, a quote from somebody that I don't respect on my book. So, you know, it's a two-way street in that regard. But I mean, I'm just so grateful to her to even consider it and go to that, because I mean, she's not, you know,
she might get that request.
Yes.
Way too much.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, thanks for,
hey, I'm glad. I hope that it turned, you haven't heard back yet. You
no, I mean, she's busy. I mean, she's in the middle of a book, probably in the middle of a tour. So, you know, it'll be a few months before, you know, that's why, you know, I give her a few months before I even start thinking about,
of
is
course,
she going to read it? So.
So this is so interesting. I can't bring this interview to a close. You're hanging. You're waiting for things to happen.
Yeah.
Is this creating that hanging feeling in the rest of your life, or is it really contained in the writing?
No, it definitely bleeds over into the rest of my life. I've been kind of in a free form, floating anxiety for quite a while. But and I actually didn't write for most of the last 8 months. I did do a few short stories, but I think once I dive back into, we're calling it Done in One, the one about the police sniper. But once I
Done in One.
There's another title that came from Jan's husband. He just something he said in conversation. He said, well, you know, well, the man behind the gun is thinking something different. I thought, well, that's a great title.
Yeah,
the man behind the
gun.
I love that. But we'll probably call it Done in One unless I can, you know, we'll see when we get to that point. But that, since that's 50-50, that's going to be my, I'm going to break the inertia with that. I'm going to try to get over this floating anxiety with that and try to move on, but not turn my back on Abnormal Man. And if we do finish Done in One, before something, and I'm able to put something together with Abnormal Man, I'm sure that, you know, I'll ask Berkeley to give it a read and see if, you know, they want to make it the fourth book. Because I'm not going to turn it in unless I like it and I'm proud of it and think it's good. But it will be more mainstream, because it's not, you know, 100% me being. Jan says that, you know, it's that I need. She says something about a train to Creepy Town, and that's what she says. You need to leave the train to Creepy Town behind every once in a while and do something different. So,
well, that should be the name of your seventh book. Well, we'll check in with you again.
Okay.
We'll have to see.
I want to.
When things happen, yeah. Man. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. It was good to talk to you today.
I'm so grateful to you, Charlie, and WREK, and Georgia Tech, and the library, and the people outside. I don't, you know, but now I'm grateful to you.
No, keep going. I'll cut it all out.
I'm grateful to Charlie Bennett. So thank you, Charlie.
Thanks for being on the show, Grant.
Thanks for tuning in to the North Avenue Lounge. My guest today was the author Grant Jerkins, whose books up until now have all come out on Berkeley Prime Crime. His most recent book is The Ninth Step. You can find out more about Grant at his website, grantjerkins.com. You can hear this whole show again by going to northavenuelounge.com. Thanks again for listening.